From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So what just happened? A lot of people were asking that question after the Patriots' comeback win over the Falcons last night. But we are talking about the big news story of the weekend, the legal battle over President Trump's temporary travel bans on citizens of seven majority Muslim nations and refugees from all countries, and the indefinite ban on refugees from Syria. On Friday, a lower court judge in Seattle blocked the travel bans across the country. Yesterday, an appeals court in San Francisco upheld that ruling, and the lawsuit, backed by nearly 100 technology companies and former Secretaries of State John Kerry and Madeleine Albright. Today, both sides face deadlines for legal briefs. And there are also lawsuits from other states and rights groups. So let's bring in legal scholar Alan Dershowitz. He joins us by Skype. Alan, what's the overview? What did happen here?
Look, this has been one mistake after the other. Travel order itself, the executive order, was a big mistake. It was overbroad. It was hastily organized. And then the judge in Seattle issued an overly hasty, overbroad, overgeneral injunction without really going into the reasons why an injunction nationwide was warranted. He should have followed the advice of the judge in Boston, Judge Gordon, who issued a 20-page, very, very thoughtful opinion, deciding the opposite way. And then the Trump administration made a terrible mistake by seeking an immediate reversal of that order without even briefs having been filed. They should have simply asked for an expedited appeal and an expedited briefing schedule. So we're seeing mistake after mistake after mistake, and that's what happens when you rush to judgment on matters of such great importance.
So, Alan, just to underscore what you've said, there was the first judge in Seattle that overturned the bans nationwide, then appeals court judges that agreed with that judge. And it sounds like you're saying because of the way the appeal was filed by the White House.
Yes, you're not going to get courts, except in extraordinary cases, rendering such an important decision without hearing from both sides. So they may well win at least a partial victory over time, but they weren't going to win an emergency reversal of the stay that had been granted earlier.
Well, hold on one second there, because I want to talk about what happens now. But since you've brought up, you know, the constitutionality of this law, we want to get your opinion on that, because as you know, I'm sure by now, Vice President Mike Pence said on Meet the Press yesterday that you agree with the travel ban legally. Let's listen.
Look, when you have people as diverse as Alan Dershowitz and Jonathan Turley, who have acknowledged the merits of the president's action under the Constitution and the law, I think it speaks for itself. We're very confident that we're going to prevail.
So, Alan Dershowitz, let's hear it from you. What are your thoughts about the law? Do you think it's constitutional?
Well, Vice President Pence engaged in another example of fake news. I have never supported this ban. I think it's outrageous. I think it's wrong as a matter of policy. I do think that parts of it may survive constitutional attack, while other parts of it don't survive constitutional attack. There is no constitutional right of a family in Yemen who's never been to the United States, has no American connections, and who's seeking a visa to travel here. There's no constitutional right for them to get a visa. That's different from a student who's here in the country studying, who goes and travels briefly and then can't return to the United States. That student does have a constitutional right that may have been violated here. This is complex. It requires a nuanced, calibrated response. And the only judge so far who's done that is the judge in the Federal District Court in Boston, Massachusetts.
Well, let me ask you quickly about the legality and constitutionality. David Byer, in his op-ed in the New York Times, points out that there is a law, the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, which banned all discrimination against immigrants on the basis of national origin. Isn't that what this law is, seven countries?
It is. The problem is this statute is narrowly applicable to only certain kinds of visa applications and not as generally applicable as the power of the president. So what we have is an interrelationship between statutes and executive orders and legislation. So this is very, very complicated. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's impossible to predict how a court will ultimately decide the cases.
Meanwhile, just a quick question to you. The phrase constitutional crisis is coming up, especially after Donald Trump tweeted over the weekend that the judge in Washington state who ruled to stay you know, the enforcement of his orders, was a so-called judge. You know, people are wondering if the president is questioning the very heart of America, which is that we have a system of checks and balances and we have a judicial branch. Your thoughts on a president tweeting that out?
Well, there's good news and there's bad news. The bad news is the president does challenge the judiciary. Calling somebody a so-called judge is just, you know, typical Trump, but it's absolutely wrong. And the president shouldn't be challenging the separation of powers and checks and balances. On the other hand, the good news, the president didn't simply defy the order. He appealed it. Now, he could have defied the order because there is a contrary order by a federal district court in Massachusetts. He could have said, look, my lawyers have read both opinions. We think the Massachusetts federal district court opinion is sounder, and we're going to obey that. Now, he would have put himself at risk of being held in contempt of court. That truly would have been a constitutional crisis. President saying things does not constitute a crisis, but a president refusing to obey an order of a court would constitute a crisis, and we're not seeing that, at least not yet.
Alan Dershowitz, professor of law emeritus at Harvard Law School. Alan, another time we will have you back to talk about your beloved Patriots.
Oh, boy, well, that was a fantastic game yesterday. Thank you, Patriots.
Alan, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, farmers in this country have been harvesting record-breaking crop yields from soybeans to corn to wheat, and that's not necessarily a good thing for the farmers. Prices for some commodities are at their lowest point in a decade, and banks that lend to farmers expect fewer of them will be able to pay back their loans. Grant Gerlach from Here and Now contributor Harvest Public Media has our story.
Elliot Chapman chose a hard time to start a farm, even if it looked like the best time. It was 2013. Grain prices were coming off historic highs. Chapman was farming with his dad and uncle near the town of Lyman on the Nebraska-Wyoming border. He decided to strike out on his own.
I was living the life, you know, ever since I was a little kid. I always wanted to do what dad did.
Farming is an expensive business, and new farmers rarely have money set aside. Chapman borrowed $94,000 to get a few tractors, a semi, a combine, a hay baler, equipment he had to have, even if most of it was 30 years old. He took out a loan to buy seed, fertilizer, and fuel.
Holy cow, was I in deep after that. Yeah, it was just that first year where things tanked. I mean, the last year was good, and then it almost went straight down.
Crop prices plummeted. Hailstorms hit. Chapman lost money 3 years in a row. Last spring, when he went back to the bank, he learned his credit had dried up.
And I had already had a crop in the ground. Yeah, we went straight to survival mode. Man, what do you do when you go in there and you got a crop in the ground and they say no? That puts a lot on a guy.
Farmers across the Midwest are trying to figure out how to get by at a time when prices for everything from corn to wheat to cattle and hogs mean they'll be struggling just to break even. Paul Bergner from Platte Valley Bank in Scottsbluff, Nebraska, says there's just more supply than demand.
Prices are low, bins are full, and the dollar's strengthening as we speak, and so that's just making that export thing a little bit more challenging.
Farm income has declined 3 years running, and there are signs of strain. Land values are down, farm debt continues to rise, and low prices have triggered a surge in payments from government programs. But if today's hard times sound like a repeat of the 1980s farm crisis, Brad Lubin says that's not the case, at least not for the farm economy as a whole.
It's difficult to call this a crisis. It's certainly a concern.
Lubin is an ag economist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and he says many farmers were able to sock away a rainy day fund when times were good. All farmers will have to cut costs on big-ticket items like fertilizer, land rent, and machinery. But despite continued downward trends, Lubin and other economists still believe farm failures will be isolated.
The number of producers that are truly in sort of financial stress with some impacts on their operations is a relatively small percentage.
Unfortunately, that small percentage includes Elliot Chapman, who ran out of money to farm but still had a debt to pay. His answer to that problem was mediation. Farm states created mediation programs after the 80s farm crisis to help farmers avoid foreclosure and the mass bankruptcies that tore through rural areas.
With mediation, they got everything from financial counselors, clear down to food stamps.
Mediation does not mean loan forgiveness. Chapman still owes the bank its money. But the plan they came up with helps him work through his debt while keeping his family's land.
The biggest thing for me is I was able to keep the family farm in the family. I didn't want to be that guy who lost the family farm. That was always my worst nightmare.
Chapman got a job at a county roads department and does freelance farm work on the side. Someday, he hopes to get his own farm up and running again. When he does, it'll be with some hard lessons learned about the ups and downs of agriculture. For Here and Now, I'm Grant Gerlach.
What makes something popular, be it a movie or a song or a politician? That's the subject of a new book by Atlantic senior editor Derek Thompson. It's called Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Derek, great to have you.
It's great to be here.
And did you find out, as you were doing the research for this book, what makes something popular?
So the book Hitmakers has two theses, which I think I can summarize in seven words. Familiarity beats novelty, and distribution beats content. So what does that mean? Familiarity beats novelty. We want to like new things, new songs, new movies. But what most of us gravitate toward are familiar surprises, new products and ideas that remind us of old products and ideas. The second thesis, distribution beats content. We also want to think that the best songs and shows and ideas will inevitably become the most popular. But the most interesting and the most important story of a new product is the story of how it got to audiences. Without distribution, a great product is doomed to oblivion, no matter how wonderful.
Well, let's go through some of the examples that you get to in here, because they're very interesting and they really span pop culture and politics and all kinds of things. You write about somebody named Raymond Loewy, who was remarkably good at predicting what would be popular. And he had a theory called MAYA, most advanced yet acceptable. What does that mean?
Raymond Loewy might be the most significant commercial artist of the 20th century, and it's ludicrous, really, how few people know his name. He was the Steve Jobs before Steve Jobs. This man and his firm designed the Exxon logo, the Lucky Strike pack, the Greyhound bus, the modern tractor, oven, refrigerator, vacuum cleaner. So how in the world did he know what all these people wanted? His theory, as you said, was MAYA, most advanced yet acceptable. He said people are torn between two forces: neophobia, a fear of new things, and neophilia, a desire to consume new ideas and products. And he said, if you want to sell something familiar, you have to make it a little bit surprising. But to sell something surprising, you have to make it a little bit familiar.
And to that point, you point out in this book that in movies, in 15 of the last 16 years, the highest grossing movie in the U.S. has been a sequel. So maybe something surprising, but also familiar.
Sequels, reboots, comic book universe extensions. And I brought this up with one film executive who said, you know, people say TV is in a golden age and the movies are obsessed with sequels. But you know what a television show is? It's an hour of entertainment followed by a bunch of sequels. Hmm. So new episodes of familiar conflicts turns out to be what audiences want from just about everything.
Speaking of movies, you point to an example in this book of something that became a hit, but it didn't become a hit at first. It became a hit after it was associated with a movie. This is the 1954 song by Bill Haley and his Comets. This is Rock Around the Clock.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around the clock tonight.
Okay, so everybody knows this song, and they know now that it was a hit, but it wasn't a hit at first. What happened?
It's the number one rock and roll song of all time. It's the second best-selling single in music history. I don't know how you can listen to it without tapping your foot. But when the song came out in 1954, it was a B-side, and a lot of people didn't tap their foot. It was mostly ignored. And here, this is the crazy, wonderful story of Rock Around the Clock. One of the few people who buys this song is a fifth-grade boy named Peter Ford. Peter is the son of a movie star, Glenn Ford, who appears in the 1955 movie Blackboard Jungle. And Glenn Ford, the movie star, is having drinks with the film's director, and the director says, you know, by the way, I need a jump jive tune for this film. Do you have any ideas? And Glenn Ford goes, well, my son, Peter, give the director some of your favorite music. And lo and behold, this 9-year-old boy hands the director Rock Around the Clock. The song plays at the beginning of Blackboard Jungle, in the middle of Blackboard Jungle, at the end of Blackboard Jungle, and only then, a few weeks after the movie comes out, does it become the number one song in America, the first rock and roll song to ever hit number one on Billboard.
And your point here is that it's not the quality of the song that made it a hit, because if it had been, it would have become a hit at the very beginning. So what was it? Why did people like it the second time around?
This goes right to the second thesis of the book. Content is less important than distribution. You have the same song come out in two different mediums, two different ways. One, in 1954, it comes out and it's kind of a flop. 12 months later, it comes out and it is the top-selling song of the decade, the second best-selling song in the history of rock and roll. So what is the actual quality of the song? You can't say. What matters is distribution and exposure.
We're speaking with Derek Thompson of The Atlantic, whose new book is called Hitmakers: The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. And Derek, on the point that you were just talking about, you also bring up the example of impressionist art. And some people may disagree with this part of it, because you make the point that a lot of the famous artwork that we know today is famous because a particular person in France decided to make it available to the public to see.
That's right. So as everybody knows, the Impressionists were widely ignored in the mid to late 19th century, and today they're among the most popular painters in the world. What happened? Well, an incredible number of the most famous Impressionist paintings come from one collection belonging to a lesser-known Impressionist named Gustave Caillebotte. Gustave Caillebotte dies early in his 40s, in the early 1890s. He bequeaths his entire collection to the Musée du Luxembourg. Essentially, the Musée de Luxembourg takes his collection, and when they hang it, it is the first time ever that Impressionist art has the imprimatur of the French government saying, yes, we are allowing this to hang in a public museum. So that generation's art historians write about those paintings, and the next generation's art historians read those generation's art historians about those paintings. And so the power of this initial moment of exposure snowballs such that these random paintings that Caillebotte collected turns out to be paintings that we can't help but see. They're absolutely everywhere. One of his paintings by Renoir, Bal du Golem de la Galette, was discarded. Nobody would buy it. Gustave Caillebotte only bought it because he wanted to be nice to his friend Renoir. In the late 20th century, this painting sold for more than $90 million to be the second most expensive painting in the history of art. So the same art pieces that were absolutely ghastly from the perspective of an 1870s art historian are now considered absolute classics 140 years later.
And to the person who listens to you say that and says, well, they are brilliant pieces of art.
If they're brilliant pieces of art, they should be as brilliant in 1870 as they are in 1970 and 2016. But the fact is they're not. And we see this as a story of culture across pop culture categories, that there are all sorts of ideas like Impressionism or the last one I mentioned, rock and roll, that are scandal, scandal, scandal. And then they have this moment of public consecration. And after that, they become culture.
One more category we have to go into, especially when we're talking about how things become popular, is politics, because these are people, politicians, who are trying to get popular support for themselves and for their ideas. And you get into that in this book and bring up some of the rhetorical tricks that politicians have used in the past. Tell us about those.
Yeah, musicologists have shown that repetition is the God particle of music. You can take essentially any sound, even the sound of a human voice, and start repeating it again, start repeating it again, start repeating it again, and the brain will suddenly just begin to hear that cacophony as music. Da-da-da-da-da-dun, da-da-da-da-da-dun. So repetition has this powerful, amazing trick of turning cacophony into music. It's also true of speech, of political rhetoric. Basically, every single example of Greek high political rhetoric is a form of repetition. There's anaphora, which is repetition at the beginning of a sentence. Winston Churchill, we shall fight them on the beaches. We shall fight them on the landing grounds.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields.
There's tricolon, which is repetition in short triplicate. Abraham Lincoln, government of the people, by the people, for the people. There's diacopy, which is repetition of a word or phrase with a brief interruption, like FDR. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Or an ABA structure. Sarah Palin, drill, baby, drill.
We will drill here and drill now, and now's when you chant drill, baby, drill. Yes.
And then there's the most famous example of repetition in rhetoric. It's called antimetaboly. If you don't remember that word, just remember ABBA. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Or Hillary Clinton, human rights are women's rights, and women's rights are human rights.
Human rights are women's rights, and women's rights are human rights, once and for all.
And that resonates because we hear it and it sounds musical to us?
Yes, that's exactly right. It works because the brain processes the music first and wants to fall in love with the music. And so we allow sometimes questionable political ideas to just flow by because they're presented in beautiful and musical ways. So this is both, yes, a trick, but also something for audiences to watch out for, because it is a way for politicians to turn any terrible idea into music.
Derek Thompson, his new book is called Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. A lot of fascinating stuff in there. You can read an excerpt at hereandnow.org. Derek, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original before-you-go toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
So there I was last night reading a great new novel about one of artist Andrew Wyeth's subjects, kind of yawning, when this happened.
Here's Edelman broken up, and the pass is no sign yet. Edelman comes down with a football, and they're saying it's a catch.
People, we have a game. Patriots receiver Julian Edelman, draped by several terrific Falcon defenders, making a flying catch of a Tom Brady pass, the ball about an inch off the ground. That catch kept a game-tying drive alive, maybe the best catch ever. It led to the first Super Bowl overtime ever, the Pats scoring on the first possession to beat the noble Falcons 34-28. The biggest comeback ever, maybe the best game ever, unless you're a Falcons fan. Sorry, guys. Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst, hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate. Mike, go. Your thoughts.
I don't know if it was the best catch ever or even in this game, because Julio Jones earlier did this toe tap on the sidelines where he went up, all 6 foot six of him, and came down with a catch. And I liken that to a Rembrandt, which was formal and had great lines and you just your breath is taken away. But the Edelman was more like a Picasso, and it was crazy and there was explosions. But the thing about the Edelman catch, that was at a point in the game where the Patriots, you know, the Patriots had 93 plays in this game, and that is about 20 more than a lot of plays. The Falcons were just gassed. They could not have defended any better for 3 3/4 quarters, but then they were out of it. So at that point, I would argue that even if Edelman didn't come up with that amazing catch, it seemed ordained that the Patriots were going down the field. Indeed, they did. And then they get a 2-point conversion. They got a couple 2-point conversions. And then when they win the coin toss in overtime where a touchdown ends it, it seemed like the Falcons had no way to stop them, and that perception proved to be sad reality for Atlanta.
Couple things. That Jones catch, the Falcons player, oh my gosh, it was ballet with the two, get to the feet both in. It was gorgeous. And until the third quarter, and for people who don't follow football, there's only four. So, you know, the Pats were down
four fractions.
The Pats were down by 25 points. The Falcons were knocking Tom Brady on his keister. They were busting up his passes. So you think it's just that they ran out of gas, as, you know, people are saying, right when something happened that inspired the Patriots, but also that coin toss. Are people maybe going to look at overtime and think, well, wait a second, is this – it's the first one ever in Super Bowl history. So they get the coin – the team that gets the, wins the coin toss has the ball. Are people maybe thinking maybe we should change it to time – amount of time played so the other team has a chance to maybe score as well?
Well, no, this was the correction of the longstanding sudden death rule, which even a single, it was sudden death, true sudden death in the past, and even a single field goal would win it. And if the Super Bowl came down to that, and let's say the Patriots drove deep into Atlanta territory and then sort of ran out the clock and kicked a, you know, all but a short field goal, there would be plenty of complaints. But I like this rule where a touchdown wins the game. Now, I will say this, that it wasn't just... it wasn't just that Atlanta was gassed. They also, let us not sugarcoat this, they also made a number of horrible mistakes after, to their credit, they got this seemingly insurmountable lead. And at one point, with 4 minutes and change left, only having to kick a very makeable field goal, Matt Ryan, who had a great game up to that point, I would argue the second best game in Super Bowl history for a losing quarterback, took a very a sack that put him out of field goal range. And from there, they couldn't come back.
A lot of ice baths today. Matt Ryan, we should say, the Falcon quarterback, NFL MVP, Brady the game MVP, and you're our MVP. Mike Pesca, thank you.
Well, thank you.
To Hawaii now, which has the dubious distinction of leading the country in homelessness, with almost 54 out of every 10,000 residents homeless. And a state senator, Josh Green, who's also a doctor, has proposed a bill that would categorize homelessness as a medical condition, allowing physicians to prescribe housing as the cure. Now, Senator Green says it will not only reduce homelessness, obviously taking people off the streets, but it would reduce health problems and ultimately save the state millions. Lawmakers in Hawaii are debating taking up that bill today. And Josh Green joins us from Hawaii. Senator, doctor, you know the debate. People say many of the most chronically homeless living on the streets are suffering such health issues that they can't handle a home. You've got to treat their problems first. You say what?
I would say this. They've got it wrong, unfortunately. Though people who have homelessness do have a complex medical condition, just treating a symptom of that homelessness, which is often the mental illness or the drug addiction or just the devastating impact of being homeless and under assault by life on the streets, isn't enough. And we have to change the paradigm directly. That's what I'm trying to do. And I'm using my medical background and experiences taking care of all people, but especially homeless individuals in the ER, into consideration.
Well, you're not the only one. I mean, other states are doing this. The housing first approach, it's called. And sometimes it means, you know, a lottery system maybe where people get homes and apartments. Absolutely no strings attached. But you're talking about a system where somebody would prescribe that somebody have a home. Who takes that prescription? I mean, how would it work? Who do you take that to?
That's a great question. So that's right. So my program, first of all, builds on Housing First, which is a brilliant approach. I totally, totally support Housing First initiatives. They work, but they don't work well enough. The difference is this. If a physician or healthcare provider in general prescribed housing, in other words, they went to the Department of Human Services and the insurers that are providing Medicaid services and said, please help me get this individual who's suffering very greatly into housing, then they'd have to decide, number one, is this person suffering chronic homelessness severely enough to merit the payment of this service? And we'd have to work with all of the other advocates to make sure they go into the right housing. But you see, the dollars for Housing First right now purely come from the budgets in the human services departments across the country, and it's never anywhere near enough. Mm-hmm. In Hawaii, our budget is only 10 cents on the dollar for what we need. We're spending $3 million. We need $30 million at least to solve the problem. If our governor gets all of his requests forwarded and approved, that's why if you tap into the Medicaid resources, which are much, much larger, you actually solve the problem. And let me be very clear on why we should use Medicaid resources to work on homelessness as a medical condition. Right now in our state, and this is indicative of many, many states, a very small percentage of our Medicaid patients, consumers, consume most of our Medicaid dollars. In Hawaii, it's 3.6% of our Medicaid patients consume 60% of our budget. Right now, it's the very same people that are suffering with homelessness. So we're spending over $1 billion for just about 12 to 15,000 people in Hawaii, and we're not helping them enough. They get called to the hospital in an ambulance. We take care of them in my ER. We patch problems. We Band-Aid problems. But we never solve their actual problem. We studied this in Hawaii, and we found that the moment you put a roof over someone's head who's suffering from chronic homelessness, you decreased their Medicaid spend by 43%. So we save millions and millions of dollars from that budget, and that's including the cost of their housing. So it really is essential to call homelessness a complex medical condition and do it that way.
Well, and there's some proof that this works. In Utah, the Housing First movement there decided to give housing to the homeless people before treating any other problems, and they've reduced homelessness by 75% and saved the state about $10,000 per homeless person. This is according to reporting from Mother Jones. Saving money, as you said.
So well, you make me smile because I have a little picture of Lloyd Pendleton, who's their leader on this issue. We brought him to Hawaii. He is definitely one of the mentors that I've had on this solution.
What about some of the questions that it raises? We know there are homeless families. Many women and children are homeless. And people might be more in line and on board with putting families into housing. But people might bristle at the idea that someone on the street, because of an alcohol problem or a drug problem, should then deserve a home. I know you know this. You can hear people saying, I can't even afford my mortgage.
Well, I think that is central to this discussion, and this is probably the most important thing we should convey to your listeners. An individual with drug or alcohol addiction and or mental illness, those are pretty much the ground zero individuals that are having the greatest challenges with chronic homelessness. If those individuals just continue to get Medicaid services in any state across the country, it's not uncommon for their spend to be $80,000, $100,000, even $120,000 per year. The moment we put them into housing through a Housing First program or through my initiative, which would be homelessness as a health condition, the minute we do that, we decrease their spend in half. That opens up those tens of thousands of dollars per individual that can now be spent on more families that are destitute and houseless. So This is both an economic solution, which is why I've been seeing a lot of people that are fiscal conservatives rally to this cause. That's why you have to look at this as a health condition, because you can't any longer take enough care of the people that really need it. And no number of dollars, no state can come up with enough money for Housing First, except I think Utah. This is the solution of the future. We are all in this very closely together, because everyone has a neighbor that's just one or two paychecks away from being in deep trouble. In our state, 200,000 of our 1.3 million people are just two to three paychecks away from losing their home.
And by the way, the thinking about both alcoholism and drug addiction is that it is a disease not a human failing. And I'm sure you'd have protections in it so that somebody couldn't just wander in from, you know, Connecticut to Hawaii and present themselves to a doctor and say, I need a house.
You're right. We do have protections, and that's essential. It would be for chronically homeless, so people that have been in Hawaii for an extended period of time, who have been homeless for more than 6 months, who would meet criteria. It's very interesting because the Trump administration is looking at all kinds of things like states' autonomy and states' rights. Well, if they go that direction, I think that states are going to have to choose their own solutions. And this would be a new solution to use Medicaid dollars more sensibly. It would also expand Hawaii's capacity by about 40% to use those Medicaid dollars. Not coincidentally, it's a 40% cut that the Republicans on the Hill have been considering for Medicaid programs. So I'm trying to get ahead of the curve on this one. We don't spend our Medicaid dollars very wisely. I say this as an ER doc who sees people every weekend when I'm on call. I say we spend them right and take care of people.
That's Hawaii State Senator and Dr. Josh Green. Josh, thanks.
Hey, it's my pleasure, and I really appreciate what you do.
Well, Queen Elizabeth II and the United Kingdom marked a milestone today. World War I-era cannons were fired to salute her Sapphire Jubilee. That's 65 years on the throne. Elizabeth is the world's longest reigning monarch. She became queen on this day in 1952 when her father, King George VI, died, and has been delivering Christmas messages ever since, like this one in 1957, in which she reflected on her role as queen.
In the old days, the monarch led his soldiers on the battlefield, and his leadership at all times was close and personal. Today, things are very different. I cannot lead you into battle. I do not give you laws or administer justice. But I can do something else. I can give you my heart and my devotion to these old islands and to all the peoples of our brotherhood of nations. I believe in our qualities and in our strength. I believe that together we can set an example to the world which will encourage upright people everywhere. I would like to read you a few lines from Pilgrim's Progress, because I'm sure we can say, with Mr. Valiant for truth, these words: though with great difficulty I am got hither, yet now I do not repent me of all the trouble I have been at to arrive where I am. My sword I give to him that shall succeed me in my pilgrimage, and my courage and skill to him that can get it. My marks and scars I carry with me, to be a witness for me, that I have fought his battles, who now will be my rewarder.
Queen Elizabeth II on Christmas Day 1957. She's now 90 years old and is today marking 65 years as queen. The Super Bowl is about a lot more than football, although the football was pretty unbelievable last night. It's about culture. So let's talk about the cultural moment that was with Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy.
So what kind of cultural moment do you think it was? We're leading into this Super Bowl. We're, you know, in a very divided country right now. We've got protests around the country every week that President Trump has been in office. And we also know that the owner and the coach and the star quarterback of the Patriots have supported President Trump in the past. People made a deal out of that. But what do you think happened last night?
Whatever you were feeling when you were watching it was amplified by whatever you see. That's my analysis. For instance, when George H. Bush and Barbara Bush came onto the pitch to do the coin toss right at the beginning, even that moment was political because people were saying, hang on a minute, he was too sick to go to the inauguration, but here he is at the Super Bowl. Thinking emoji face.
He did look good, though, last night on the field.
Excellent. Yeah. In good health. And then there were other political moments, like Sean Spicer, the now famous White House press secretary, when it was going so well for the Atlanta Falcons in the first half, you would see little memes of Sean Spicer saying, it's going very well for the Patriots. We are winning in the first half of the game, which actually made me chortle out loud as I was watching this. But whatever your politics, whatever you were feeling, was basically being reflected in what you were seeing in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, and let's talk about the halftime performance, because Lady Gaga, she was, you know, a lot of people had expected her to be very political. She has been in the past. People thought maybe she would say something about President Trump. But instead, there was a different situation. She was hoisted on ropes down from the top of the stadium to the stage, although it looked like at one point she just jumped off. I had no idea what was going to happen to her. But and then she sang America the Beautiful. She sang a part of This Land Is Your Land by Woody Guthrie.
Very patriotic.
Very patriotic. And then her hit Born This Way. Let's listen. So if you can't hear what she's saying there, no matter gay, straight, or bi, was she sending a political message, do you think?
I'm just going to quote Lady Gaga right back at you from the New York Times. She says, the only statement that I will be making during the halftime show are the ones that I've been consistently making throughout my career. Born This Way came out in 2011. It was a huge hit then. It became an anthem for people who felt that they were marginalized. That political message she was saying then is as true today as it was then. If that's how you see it, that is how she meant you to see it.
Were you surprised, though, that she didn't get more overtly political?
Well, people were saying ahead of time, at InfoWars, for example, was predicting that Lady Gaga was about to conduct a satanic ritual at the Super Bowl. So people were expecting, their expectations were very high, but what they got was pure Lady Gaga in terms of spectacle and outfits and jumping off into nowhere. Lots of memes coming up of that performance. But she didn't mention the president.
And no wardrobe malfunction like we saw with Janet Jackson. And of course, last year we had Beyonce's halftime performance and she had her backup dancers wearing outfits that were compared to the way the Black Panthers dressed.
And people were willing Beyonce to turn up because there was a little mashup of a hit, Telephone, where Beyonce and Lady Gaga were singing. And they were, it's in Houston. That's where Beyonce lives. Maybe she will turn up. But then Lady Gaga moved on to the next song.
All right, let's talk about the ads just briefly. 84 Lumbers ad featured an immigrant from Latin America and her daughter who leave their home early one morning to make the trek to the U.S. Let's listen.
¿Estás lista? Sí.
The translation there being, are you ready? They ride in a pickup truck, walk across the desert, and the ad sends you to a website to see the end, see if they make it. What did you make of this ad?
I was just wondering when this ad was bought. I think there were open slots about a week before the Super Bowl, so there was still time for ads to be bought. So I was really curious about the timing for this. Reportedly, the original ad had the mum and the daughter who were traveling from Mexico heading to the border of the U.S. There was a door, and then there was a little gap in the door, and they walked through the door in this huge wall. There is no subtext to this ad, none whatsoever. Now, apparently they were asked, the 84 Lumber was asked to actually cut that part of the ad, and they said to everybody viewing, go to journey84.com so you can see the full ad. It's almost 6 minutes, and you see that very end of the ad going through the wall, and at the end, the will to succeed is always welcome here. That's it.
Hmm. You also liked a Snickers ad. Tell us about that one.
It was live. Can you imagine a live Super Bowl ad? Who would do that? How do you amaze an audience that have seen everything, seen so many Super Bowls, seen so many amazing ads? And then there was the Snickers ad. And basically, everything went wrong for 30 seconds. A cowboy came out. Cowboy was played by Adam Driver from Star Wars and Girls. And he was about to set a scene where he saves the town. The gunshots went off too early. People dropped on the floor too early. The whole shantytown dropped on the floor too early. Woman came out, said her line too early. And it all went horribly wrong. This all happened live. Amazing.
Yeah. And they planned it. They planned it that way.
It was all planned. Yeah. So even if it went wrong, how would we even know?
Right.
And the end of the line was, the end of the ad was, you ruin live Super Bowl commercials when you're hungry. And then a big Snickers bar underneath there.
Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, thanks.
You're welcome.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.